Welcome on in to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Avi, today we have a very exciting show.
We're all over the place today.
Yeah, we're talking clotheslines, diving knee drops, DDTs, loud, pushy, big personalities, and lots of rivalries. What is it, Avi?
You want me to answer?
Yeah. WrestleMania.
Okay. I was going to do a wrestling voice and everything.
Are you going to do wrestling voice?
I was setting it up. It's okay.
Save it for later. Well, WrestleMania is hitting Philly this weekend. Thousands of fans. WrestleMania 40 is taking over the link Saturday and Sunday. We'll get all the deets and we'll talk to experts about why in the world people love WrestleMania so much. We have podcast host and wrestling aficionado Bob Smith, as well as WHYY's own Corey Sharber, who loves wrestling apparently since he was a kid, and he's doing a lot of our local coverage.
And then I said we're going to be all over the place today.
Yes.
We're going to talk with Paul Offit, who works at CHOP, who is a vaccine expert, who was right in the thick of our response to the COVID crisis.
Yes.
He's written a new book, looking back over the last 4 years. A lot happened. You probably don't remember all of it. You might have missed it even when it happened. The book is called Tell Me When It's Over. It's an interesting read. Mm-hmm. It's a quick read, but you learn a lot from it. And we're going to ask him about, you know, what we got right, what we got wrong, but also, you know, are we prepared for the next crisis?
Yeah, lots of lessons learned, hopefully. And then later this segment, the countdown to the eclipse.
We had to get in on the eclipse coverage.
We'll give you some details, some local details. And also, a shout out to Jennifer Lynn, Morning Edition host. She's going to be hosting a viewing party. We'll give you all the details on that as well.
We sure will. But first, some headlines. Cherry, you are, of course, aware of the phenomenon of fare evasion on public transit.
Yeah.
This is when folks, sneak into the station, get on the bus without paying, somehow ride without, you know, forking over some money.
Mm-hmm.
SEPTA has a new pilot program to try to crack down on fare evasion, which they say is costing them $30 to $40 million a year in revenue. The pilot program involves these high-tech gates that they're installing at 69th Street Station, which is a big terminal, right? It's the Norristown High-Speed Line. It's the end of the Market Frankford Line. They're installing these gates. They're very high. They're plastic. They're hard to jump over. I don't know if anyone could jump over them. And they also come equipped with technology that would allow them to capture the image of fare evaders and then, you know, later bring them to justice. The downside, I suppose, is that they're very expensive. It's $1 million for 20 of these gates. But they're going to see how it works, and they are going to, at least they hope to, use this technology and other strategies to stop people from fare evading.
Yeah, that $30 to $40 million seems like a lot of money to be losing every year for
especially
this.
Especially at this time for SEPTA.
Yeah, also, we want to feel safe. And I'm thinking, if I see somebody jumping the turnstiles, it says that there's a lot of chaos or disorder going on.
Right.
And so just being able to stop that, I think, and they've also linked, you know, the folks who tend to be evaders are more likely to participate in criminal activity.
Right. Their claim, and they're not the only ones making this claim. Other major transit systems make this claim as well, is that a lot of the antisocial behavior that you will see on public transit is traced back to people who are fare evaders. Mm-hmm. And that if you can, I guess, keep those people out of the system, you can boost public trust overall in public transit. And I should say, these types of initiatives are going on in D.C.
Yeah, Chicago.
And in Chicago and in the Bay Area, all around the country, there is a renewed effort to cut down on fare evasion. Like anything in this arena, that means more confrontation.
Yes.
That means a type of policing. And that comes with its own consequences.
That has its own. Yeah, and you're right. And the fine is $25. You know, they've already been trying to do it. They've had like 2,700 citations, but clearly it's not stopping it. Hopefully these nearly 8-foot gates will, because how are you going to jump over that, right?
You're not jumping.
So, you're not jumping.
Maybe you're pushing through.
You're not
maybe
jumping.
Well, and sometimes people tailgate someone. Mm-hmm. And that's a way that people often sort of evade fares. Mm-hmm. And we'll see how effective this is against that.
Yeah, at least they're trying to do something. Going over to New Jersey, a new report came out showing that there's thousands of students that are still chronically absent in the Garden State. That's according to this New Jersey School Performance Report. It came out on Wednesday. This report looks at the 2022-23 school year, Ivy, and finds that 16.6% of New Jersey's 1.4 million students were chronically absent. That's about a quarter of a million students. Chronic absenteeism is when you miss 10% or more of school days. The last time they tracked this was back in 2018-2019, and chronic absenteeism was hovering around 10%. And so we clearly, you know, the pandemic is over and there's still this uptick.
Let me just recap. It mm-hmm. went from about 10% mm-hmm. of students chronically absent
to now 16.6% of students. Students who are in pre-K tend to be the most chronically absent. Officials say it's probably because parents are kind of keeping kids home, you know, if they're sick or if they've been exposed to COVID. So it's adding to the number of days. But they're not really sure. But they said, you know, transportation issues, busing issues, also a major problem. Some schools had as much as 44% chronic absenteeism. And those were outliers, but that's a large number of students missing more than 10% of school. And if you're not in class, how can you learn, right?
Yeah. Definitely alarming numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Hard to tell, I guess, with this is like the raw data, right?
Yeah, raw data.
It doesn't come with cause and effect. It doesn't tell you why. It doesn't tell you if this is somehow traced back to the decision to close schools initially and if that created disruption that is lingering today. Perhaps it was other types of disruptions created by the pandemic, but clearly there is a before number and an after mm-hmm. number. They're not the same number. They're not even really close to the same number. So something happened.
Something happened. And there's
and
also...
I don't think we still don't feel like we have our arms around this here.
Yeah,
I don't know.
And I also think culture has changed. And I've seen articles talking about the culture.
Parents has changed.
Being more comfortable with keeping their kids home from school. And that kind of happened during the pandemic.
Because they were virtual.
Also, because of illness. You know, I remember back in the day when I was a kid, you used to send your kid to school sick.
Right.
If they have the sniffles, you're a little nervous because of the pandemic. Do I keep them home if they're not 100%? And so I think the culture sort of shifted that if there's any type of illness, keep your kid home. That's a default.
I guess I should be careful, but that... applied the right way, that could be an okay thing, right? Mm-hmm. Like you could still learn online, you get some of your work done, and you don't infect other people. Even with a non-COVID illness, mm-hmm. I could see that having some benefit.
Yeah.
But chronic absenteeism
is just a little too much. Yeah.
Okay.
We'll see.
A lot to dig into there, maybe another day.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this next story is something I don't know anything about.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. April 6th. Coming up, it is the official start of trout season.
Yes.
In Pennsylvania. 3.2 million trout have been released in Pennsylvania waters. I guess
wow.
you can go catch them now.
Mm-hmm. Golden rainbow trout, all kinds of trout.
I don't know what else to say about this. Trout, it's a fish, Cherry.
Mm-hmm.
They're delicious. They taste good. If you catch them, I believe you're allowed to catch 5 of them that are at least 7 inches long.
Mm-hmm.
And then I guess you can cook them and eat them. You need to have a license. What else should we say about trout, Cherry?
There are 2 days in Pennsylvania where you can fish for free without this license. And those days are Sunday, May 26th, and Thursday, July 4th. Otherwise, mm-hmm. you got to take the correct steps.
Do our producers want to tell us anything more about trout? Producer Debbie Builder, you love trout season. Right? You're a big fisher, no? Okay, she's shaking her head.
Okay.
Have you ever fished?
I did. I fished with my uncle growing up.
Oh, really?
The only thing I ever caught was a turtle, which shows you that your girl is not good at fishing.
What? First of all, you went fishing several times?
Yes, my uncle was a big fisherman.
And you never caught a fish?
I think I caught like a catfish and it grossed me out. So I threw it back. But then the main thing that I caught that I remember the most was a turtle.
That's really horrifying. Terrible.
Now, did you fish?
I identify with turtles just as a creature.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I like them. They're cute.
They are kind of cute.
Yeah. I've been fishing just a handful of times. It's not for me. It's not for me. It's I find it a little bit boring, but I...
You like more exciting sports.
Well, not wrestling level exciting.
Okay.
But maybe a little more than standing on a boat or in the water.
It's peaceful, man. It's peaceful.
Yeah, that's
you can
true.
Have conversations.
You know what? Disconnect from your device and go fishing. Actually, I could get on board with that.
Exactly. I think now we're going to move on to our newsmaker.
Trout.
as everyone knows by now, there is an eclipse coming on Monday. In our region, the best time to see it will begin a little after 2 o'clock in the afternoon. The entire country, though, they're getting all revved up about this. There's a little eclipse mania going on, don't you think, Avi?
It's not quite to the level of trout mania, but it's getting there, Cherry. Mm-hmm. So we asked our favorite astronomer, Swarthmore's Eric Jensen, to give us the lowdown on what we can expect to see with our eclipse glasses on, of course. Eric, welcome back to Studio 2.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
So, Eric, here in Philadelphia, I remember there was a partial eclipse like back in 2017, and I remember looking at it with my glasses on, of course. So explain to me why Monday's eclipse is so special.
Yeah, so it'll be similar to what we saw in 2017. So we're in a position here in Philadelphia where the moon passes mostly in front of the sun, but we're not lined up quite right to have it totally eclipse the sun. So from here, it'll be about 89 at peak at about 320 or so. It'll be 89% eclipse. So you'll see the sun if you have the right, like you're saying, have the right glasses on or have a way to project an image of the sun. You'll see the sun be just sort of a thin crescent as the moon is mostly blocking it.
Eric, what gear do I need? We've alluded to these glasses. What gear do I need and what should I be looking for?
Yeah, so they make special eclipse, what are called eclipse glasses. A lot of places in the region, especially public libraries, if you have a local public library, check out their website. Free Library of Philadelphia has a listing of a bunch of places in the region that are doing it. Franklin Institute, if you're in Center City, will have an event. These are like super, super dark sunglasses. You couldn't walk around wearing them because you'd fall down. But if you have those glasses on, you can look directly at the sun and you can see that thin crescent. The other thing that I love to do during an eclipse is we're a little early, so a lot of the trees don't have leaves on it. But if you find a tree that has leaves, that sort of dappled sunlight that's under the trees is a bunch of tiny little circles that are little images of the sun. And so if you look at the sort of shade during an eclipse, you'll see instead of a bunch of tiny little circles, you'll see a bunch of little crescents. So that's one of my favorite ways to see what's going on up in the sky.
That's a new little tidbit I hadn't heard before. Thank you for that, Eric. Got to ask you, so there's a critical time, little after 2 o'clock, that we can begin watching this and see the full effects. How long will that last?
Right. So it starts a little bit after 2, and right at first, it'll be hard to see that anything's going on. But as the moon gradually moves across the sun, for about 2.5 hours, there'll be something to see. And a little bit after 3 is when it'll be at its peak. You don't have to see it exactly at that moment. It's kind of a leisurely activity as the moon kind of cruises across the sun. But, 3-ish, 3 to 3:30 there is the peak viewing time. So hopefully people can get outside and check it out. And hopefully we'll get clear weather.
Just a minute left, Eric, but... this is also a scientific event. NASA is shooting some rockets up into space for some reason or another. Can you explain, what scientists are hoping to learn during this eclipse?
Yeah, so one thing that you can do during the eclipse is that it blocks out the really bright, the moon during in the path of totality blocks out the really bright part of the sun. And so there are some faint outer layers called the corona that we're normally not able to see, but that that can be viewed during the eclipse. And the other thing apparently NASA is looking at is that the sun affects Earth's atmosphere, and that can potentially affect communication satellites and things like that. And so being able to sort of watch as that changes, as the sun gets more eclipsed and then less, they can explore some of that during an eclipse.
Interesting. Well, that is Eric Jensen, professor of astronomy at Swarthmore College, and our guide for the upcoming eclipse. We always love having you on Studio 2, breaking down all these scientific concepts for us. Thanks again, Eric.
Thanks a lot.
And by the way, WHYY is hosting an eclipse viewing event. You can join our morning edition host and producer, Jennifer Lynn, on Monday, along with fellow WHYY audience members for a viewing party at Haverford Reserve Grass Field. More information and everything you need to register can be found at WHYY.org/events.
Coming up, we're talking wrestling on Studio 2.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I've been hearing a lot of smack talk recently from other radio programs trying to put Studio 2 down, saying we're too chatty and irreverent, whatever that means. That's why I can't wait for Radio Mania 2024 in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Oh, morning edition, you're gonna be in mourning when we're done with you. All things considered, consider this elbow to the face. Marketplace, we're gonna mark your face with bruises, fresh air. Oh, I've been waiting for you, fresh air. We're gonna put a fresh pair of boots up your you-know-what. In any other radio program that wants to come after Studio 2, know this. You're going to be begging for a pledge break, brother, when all is said and done. Because that's what the Studio 2 tag team does.
Avi, I'm glad to be your tag team partner. Let me tell you.
Are we ready? Are we in the right frame of mind?
We're in the right frame of mind. And let me tell you, Cherry Bombshell, can't wait for the fresh air people to show up on our doormat. I'm ready.
We're going to call it Dynamo Dave Davies versus the Avenger. That's me. You're Cherry Bombshell. It does sound like a good idea.
It does.
Checked with insurance. I checked with HR. They said it was a no-go. Radio Mania 2024 was canceled as soon as it began. I apologize.
It's all good. We're going to leave it up to the pros. And the good news is they are coming into town. WrestleMania 40, it's happening in Philly this weekend. It's a huge pro wrestling event with names like Dwayne, The Rock, Johnson, or Cody Rhodes.
As you probably could tell from that very bad promo, the producers thought it was not a good idea to have the two of us talk about wrestling for 20 minutes. So we brought in some experts. Who are they, Cherry?
They are WHYY reporter Corey Sharber, who is a wrestling enthusiast and reported on multiple wrestling events. We also have Bob Smith, former managing editor of Pro Wrestling Illustrated. He's also podcast host for the Outdated Wrestling Hour. Bob and Corey, welcome to Studio 2.
Yeah, thanks for having us. I wish you should gotta be careful talking about the fresh air crew, because when Terry Gross gives you a tombstone pile driver,
I know that's right.
I don't know how I'm going to follow up that opener. Holy smokes!
Maybe I should ask, how was my technique? Was that a decent? I think that's called a promo, right?
That was a promo.
What is a promo?
You nailed it. You nailed it. It was very 1986, but you did nail it.
So yeah, it was an old school wrestling promo, was what
right.
I did.
Yeah.
You know what's so funny? And by the way, if you want to chime in, 888-477-9499, you can email studio2@whyy.org. What's so interesting to me is that, you know, I just riffed that. I kind of did it in a take. I have never sat down and watched a wrestling match, but my reference was just all these clips I've seen online circulating of new and old wrestling promos and wrestling videos. And maybe I'll start with you, Bob. Like, how has social media helped expose professional wrestling to a new generation?
Like crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like there have been many, many phases in wrestling since I started watching back when Methuselah was a young boy. I started watching wrestling in 1970. So there have been many changes. To speak of what you're talking about, first of all, the advent of cable TV killed the territories. Then the internet killed the magazines, right? When everybody got their, you know, wrestling news from the magazines. But now it's expanding wrestling in terms of the big two companies with social media. They all have Facebook accounts. They're all on Instagram. They're all posting everything they do. If Becky Lynch goes and eats a piece of blueberry pie, it's a video of it somewhere, you know?
Yeah.
So it's just, they're like movie stars now, to be honest with you. The coverage they get. And you know something? Back when I was with the magazines, we would go to major cards and there'd be like three reporters there.
That's a major bout.
Yeah. A major bout. Yeah. Now, with these huge mega cards they have, they're covered by the mainstream media like I never thought I would see in my lifetime. I mean, Forbes has a wrestling writer. Forbes magazine.
Forbes magazine,
yeah.
So how do you explain that, Bob? Like, how do you, because you mentioned the regionals. Like, it used to kind of be regional circuits, right?
Sort
of.
Right.
There was one in the East Coast and the South, and you know, and it was kind of balkanized. And then it became this big conglomerate, WWF, then WWE. And I know they have rivals and stuff, but, like, how did that evolution happen? Why did it happen?
Well, it happened around the advent of the cable era, around 84.
Yeah.
I should say cable era. And Vince McMahon Jr., who ran the WWF at that point, decided to go and buy up every big name piece of talent he could. And because he knew he had cable TV exposure, the smaller territorial people couldn't keep up with it, and they just shriveled up one by one. And by the early 90s, he was the only game in town.
Wow.
Now we have AEW that's chasing on his coattails, but the fact is, right now, the WWE is, Corey could probably vouch for, it's blazing red hot, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the fact is, like, I mean, AEW, like, no offense to them, I mean, they did a stadium show in England not too long ago, but that wasn't two nights. And that was the first one they've done. The WWE's done WrestleMania. How many football stadiums in this country?
Wow.
You know, and I mean, yeah, I mean, right now. Also, WWE is a publicly traded company. I mean, the fact you can buy stock in a wrestling company is kind of nuts. I don't think AEW has anything like that at the moment. No offense.
Yeah.
That's so fascinating.
And I want to talk about WrestleMania because it's coming this weekend. I want you to kind of, before we start going, what it takes to build something so huge. Let's talk about WrestleMania. Like, what is it? How big is it? What is the vibe of this thing that has been going on for decades? And Bob, I'll start with you, and Corey, we'll get your take. Yeah.
This may be the biggest WrestleMania of all time in here in Philadelphia this weekend. And I'll tell you why. You have a football stadium that's going to be filled to capacity two nights in a row. And I think it's going to produce a Taylor Swift-like economic windfall for the city of Philadelphia. There's no question about that.
Mm-hmm.
You've got all those people, all those hotels, all those restaurants all humming. You've got peripheral events like conventions and wrestling cards, like Corey just saw one yesterday, right?
Yeah, yeah.
All kinds of things are going on. I'm walking the streets out here, and I see people with their, you know, Becky Lynch T-shirts or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But to answer your question, so it's going to be huge for Philadelphia. But how did it get this big? Really good marketing.
Yeah.
I mean, superb, subtle. This isn't a commercial, but it is a commercial. You have to remember that Monday Night Raw is on for 3 hours every Monday night. It's essentially a commercial for people to watch pay-per-view events or watch Peacock where they show or to go to a live show. Pro wrestling is the only thing where they can charge top dollar for you to be a studio audience, basically.
Mm. Yeah.
Most shows, you get in for free.
Yeah. And Corey, you said 3 years old, your first exposure. You're in your 20s now.
Yeah.
What drew you to this? And what is it like for you, a lifelong fan turned reporter now, covering the, I mean, just talk about your love of professional wrestling. What is it about it that draws you in?
Yeah. I mean, as a kid, I mean, it was literally like watching like real life superheroes. I mean, these people are, you know, jumping off the top rope, doing all these backflips and whatnot. You always have people like, you know, a great example, I think he'll be performing at WrestleMania this weekend, Rey Mysterio. He's this like little masked luchador who, you know, is constantly finding himself in these David versus Goliath battles where he's this like 5'5", 7 guy somehow toppling like the 7 foot giant and winning like the world heavyweight title and things like that. I guess the reason I stuck with it, you know, my parents thought I was going to grow out of it. And then here we are 24 years later and I'm like going to wrestling shows all the time. I wear wrestling shirts at the office. I think they greatly underestimated how much I really like this stuff. But I mean, as a reporter, I mean, this is like, you know, to be here in Philadelphia, a place I've always wanted to live in for starters, to have the biggest wrestling event in the world right down, you know, literally right down the block from a lot of us. You know, it's great not just because, you know, of how big and gargantuan this event is, but because of all the other smaller events that are popping up around the area as well. Like last night I was at this show in Germantown called WrestleJohn, which great name for a wrestling event. And I interviewed this one wrestler, his name's Paul London. And growing up, Paul London was literally one of my favorite wrestlers. And you two are looking at me like, well, who the hell is Paul London? Yeah. And I mean, Paul London was, he was a cruiserweight wrestler. So he was like, you know, one of the smaller guys on the roster. So when you see a person like John Cena with his bulging biceps or Brock Lesnar, like this guy would kind of look like a normal guy, kind of like the rest of us. But he was going in the ring doing these crazy, like shooting star presses, doing all these backflips and just having all these incredible matches. And here I am, like right next to him at this brewery in Germantown, just talking to him backstage. I'm like, man, what a small world we live in. And it's like, I want to also note, like, pro wrestlers and pro wrestling fans are some of the nicest people you'll come across. You know, it's literally like we're all just celebrating just how bizarre we all are and connecting on that, you know.
Yeah, and I think about that, Bob. I want to bring you back in the conversation because I'm hearing Corey talk about these characters. Mm-hmm. It takes a lot. And Avi and I, Avi did a great job on that promo, but it takes a lot to sort of like create these characters, big, small, big personalities, doing these feats. They're more than just athletes. They're actors. There's so many things.
Mm-hmm. They have their own unique personalities. And, you know, on that note, I think one of the big reasons for the emergence of wrestling at this particular moment in its history is the emergence of the woman wrestler and the female fan.
Mm-hmm.
They are equal to the men in terms of how they're promoted, how they're shown on television, equal time straight away. It's the healthiest thing to happen to the sport in 30 years.
We've come a long way from Miss Elizabeth. I don't know if you remember
exactly.
Miss Elizabeth. We've come a long way.
Who was Miss Elizabeth? You got to fill
she
me
was
in
like there. The first lady of wrestling for a long time. She was like more like a sidekick.
Yes.
She'd be on the phone. She'd be talking stuff, kind of stirring, but she wasn't an actual wrestler. She was kind of like the promotional person.
Well, she was very pretty, and she was
dressed in like very feminine clothes. Now they're athletes kicking butt.
Right.
Yeah. Well, can I just reestablish something? WrestleMania.
Mm-hmm.
You say it's the biggest event of the year. So it's sort of like, is someone getting crowned a champion? Like, what is the actual outcome of WrestleMania?
Well, I think the big main event for this WrestleMania is going to be Cody Rhodes versus Roman Reigns. And Roman Reigns has been the Universal Champion for over 1,000 days,
which is unusual.
That's long.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we haven't seen.
And Cody Rhodes is the son of this very famous wrestler, correct? Dusty Rhodes.
Yes.
Right?
So Dusty Rhodes
was the American
dream. Cody Rhodes is the American nightmare. Now, Dusty Rhodes was a very successful wrestler back in his day. I mean, his influence is still felt to this day of all the people he was training in the WWE. And Cody Rhodes, Dusty Rhodes never won the big title in the WWE.
So his son is trying to do what his dad couldn't do. And he is going to face this guy, Roman Reigns. And whoever wins the match is the champion?
What do they get?
Well, they get a nice pretty belt.
It's big, right?
It's a big belt. And you can buy it at WWE Shop right now. But it's like, Roman Reigns has been this, he calls himself the tribal chief. He has just this, it's interesting because he was what they call a baby face for so many years, like being the good guy.
He was a good guy.
And I remember going and seeing him live like 8 years ago, and half the crowd was booing him because they were just sick of him. They just, no one wanted to cheer for this guy. And then he finally becomes a heel, which
That's
is a bad guy.
Yes.
And the fans immediately were like, finally, this is what we've been wanting.
Hmm. But the storylines. I mean, look, we got the backstory from Corey, but Bob, this is a key part of what makes wrestling and WrestleMania so popular.
Exactly. Like for the 2 days, this is actually a 2-day event. And what it is, it's all the intermingling and finales to all these storylines, all these feuds, all these controversies, all these personalities. So if you're looking for the period at the end of a sentence in terms of two wrestlers who are combating against each other, WrestleMania is it. It's like the World Series. That's it for another year. You know what I'm saying? So it's what would you say, Corey? I mean, is that a good way of putting it? It's kind of like the finale to a lot of different storylines.
Yeah, they all kind of converge at WrestleMania.
Like he mentioned, like this is like the period to end all sentences. I would say this is the exclamation point. Yeah. I mean, this is,
good
mean, I was speaking with a gentleman who actually is the GM at the Wells Fargo Center. He actually went to WrestleMania 15, 25 years ago at that same arena. He still has a ticket stub and everything. You can read about it on WHOY.com.
But
but it's nuts because he was telling me like how, like, when he went to that event, it felt bigger than a wrestling event. And I think now that, you know, the price is literally, you know, I mean, it's, the price is on the current ticket. It's outgrown arenas. It's at a football stadium for 2 days.
What are the prices?
Oh, I don't want to. I don't want to give away my net worth here, but I cannot afford them.
Yeah.
I'm not going either. It had nothing to do with the price, but I did see a chart when it was first announced, and you know, the $1,800 ringside seat and the $180 nosebleed seat. You know what I'm saying? So it is not a cheap date.
I want to make sure we get this in though, because we're talking success story, but there have been so many scandals associated with WWF and then WWE over the years. Controversies around steroids, concussions, the latest, you know, Vince McMahon, who was the face of WWE, maybe the most important wrestling executive of all time, facing allegations of sex trafficking and sexual assault. Oof. I mean, does WWE, Bob, need a culture change, or perhaps is all of this scandal actually good for business? Because sometimes I get that sense when I read about it online.
Oh, I hope that's not true. Yeah. You know, I hope that's not true.
Because it's weird, because McMahon is a character in the universe and he's a villainous character, and yet now we have this parallel of potentially villainous things that he's done in real life. And sometimes I wonder if we are truly separating sort of the fictional world of WWE from the real world and what the business of how WWE is actually run.
Well, you know, there's been controversies. You go back to the 80s, and, you know, all kinds of things were going on between steroid use and he was on trial for steroid trafficking. Forgive me if I'm saying that wrong, but, you know, he was exonerated on that. Mm-hmm. But you know, it's a situation where if he did the crime, he should do the time, as far as I'm concerned. There's no gray. I don't see a lot of gray area in these allegations. Mm-hmm. So it's frightening to me what's gone down there.
But I guess my broader question is, does WWE need to step back and reflect on, given these allegations, sort of like where it is as a company?
On a corporate level, absolutely. Yeah. But the thing is, here you go. They're selling a product at the same time. Yeah. So are they actually going to come out and announce, hey, we're going to do this differently? That's an internal thing. Mm. And I think what happened in this case is an internal, you know, with an employee type of thing. It's so sordid. You know, I don't know what to make of it all other than, like I said,
yeah,
you're right. They have to rethink what they do corporately. If that was allowed to fester and grow, get rid of that. You know, cut that off the snake. It's got to go.
Yeah, we only have about a minute and a half left. We got a lot of big stars coming to Philadelphia. We got Lil Wayne. We got Meek Mill's going to be here. We heard that Philadelphia Eagle Jason Kelce is going to make an appearance, possibly. How big of a deal is this for folks to get in front of this audience and the diversity of this audience? These tens of thousands of people are going to be there. Like, is it a game changer for some folks in their career? Like, what is this?
Well, I mean, like, let's say, like, Cody Rhodes, if he finishes the story, his career is forever set in stone with the biggest WrestleMania event that's ever happened, right? But then it's also, I think it's not just, you know, having that WrestleMania moment in front of 60,000 plus people. It's about all the people who have never watched wrestling that are going to be getting into this stuff now, because what's going on at the same? Why are all these fireworks going off? You know, I think that arguably is the bigger piece of the puzzle. Is all the people who usually aren't into this getting into this because of the spectacle of it all, you know?
But also, Bob, people are going to capitalize on this audience. You got other folks piggybacking who are not in wrestling who want to piggyback on the phenomenon.
You betcha. When B.B. King was a younger blues artist, his manager had him open for the Rolling Stones, which created a whole new audience for him. Mm-hmm. And I think the musicians and actors look at it the same way. Being seen by all these people can open some doors.
Yeah, great example, Bad Bunny. He had the WWE belt at one point, performed with it on Saturday Night Live. I mean, that's great marketing for the WWE, don't you think?
I do.
That was Corey Sharper, reporter here at WHYY. Corey, thanks for joining us today.
Absolutely.
Bob Smith, former managing editor of Pro Wrestling Illustrated, podcast host of the Outdated Wrestling Hour. Thank you, Bob, for being with us.
I got to go take my afternoon nap, but thank you very much. I appreciate it.
And coming up next on Studio 2, what have we learned from the COVID-19 pandemic? We have Dr. Paul Offit with us. Coming up next, we'll be right back.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. I want you to think back to 2020. COVID-19 was spreading. A global pandemic had been declared a national emergency in March. And the CDC on April 3rd announced new guidelines recommending people mask outdoors. It was A very frightening time.
We were hungry for information. We were desperate for vaccines. And during that time, we often turned to Dr. Paul Offit to help us understand the virus, the masking mandates, and the vaccines when they eventually became available. Offit is the director of the Vaccine Education Center at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. He was the co-inventor of the rotavirus vaccine and a member of the FDA's Vaccine Advisory Committee.
Now, 4 years later, after more than 3 million deaths around the globe, when we are finally in a better place, Paul Offit is looking back at the lessons learned and how we can apply them to the next pandemic. His new book is Tell Me When It's Over, An Insider's Guide to Deciphering COVID Myths and Navigating Our Post-Pandemic World. Welcome back to Studio 2, Paul.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
Paul, this is a book where sometimes it seems like we alternate between discussing miracles, incredible things that science achieved, and then incredible failures of science and public messaging. And it's sort of like whiplash going back and forth between them. I want to start with something that seemed miraculous to me, which I had forgotten. This virus emerges very late 2019 in China. By January 2020, scientists had isolated the virus and cracked its genetic code. To a layperson, that sounds amazing. Was it amazing?
Yes, it was amazing how quickly it was done. And then what happened to me that was remarkable was you had, in 11 months, using a technology that had never been used to make vaccines before, messenger RNA, you had done two large clinical trials, Pfizer 40,000, Moderna 30,000, showing that the vaccine worked and was safe. And then in 7 more months, you'd vaccinated 70% of the United States population when there really wasn't an infrastructure to vaccinate adults, at least massively. That, to me, was the greatest scientific and medical accomplishment in my lifetime. And my lifetime includes the development of the polio vaccine.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Let's hit that again. The greatest scientific achievement of your lifetime.
Yes, in terms of how quickly it was made, how effectively it was made, and knowing this was an unusual virus. It had an unusual biological characteristics, unusual clinical characteristics, and we used a technology with which we had no previous experience. I mean, I'm on the FDA Vaccine Advisory Committee. We were all nervous about what we would find because, you know, when you test tens of thousands of people, you're recommending the drug for hundreds of millions of people, and you know there's going to be another shoe that drops. I mean, that there's going to be a serious side effect. The only question is how rare and how serious. And for the most part, the mRNA vaccines were remarkably safe.
And I got to ask you this question, because did we just get lucky? And I say this because you talk about polio as an example of a miraculous vaccine, but people died, children died in this process. Did we get lucky with the COVID-19 vaccines in that it just happened to have worked and been way more effective than we even imagined?
Yes, I think we did get lucky. We were certainly surprised. I mean, I remember Dr. Fauci talking to us and saying he was hoping it could be 50% effective against serious disease, meaning the kind of disease that causes you to be hospitalized. Then as we got closer to the time when it was going to be authorized, he was hoping it could be as high as 75% effective. It was 90 to 95% yeah. effective. I think we were all surprised because there was essentially no experience with this kind of technology to make a vaccine.
Yeah, you saw the data and you were stunned.
Mm-hmm. Stunned. We all were.
Now, that's one of the triumphs.
Mm-hmm.
But it is juxtaposed with some what you consider grave shortcomings, including the fact that the FDA approved hydroxychloroquine for COVID treatment. And I don't know if people even remember that one because there was ivermectin. I mean, there was like a million of these supposed treatments. Remind folks what happened, why the FDA did approve this for COVID treatment, and how political pressure may have played a role.
Well, political pressure definitely played a role. I think the government, the Trump administration, was looking for a magic medicine, and they settled on hydroxychloroquine. It had been promoted by a researcher in France. It had been promoted by a woman named Stella Emanuel, who's part of America's Frontline Doctors, which was this kind of right-wing group. And he wanted a magic medicine, and so the government bought 30 million doses of this product. Hydroxychloroquine is an anti-malarial drug, and then the FDA approved it at the end of March. Mm. without any evidence that this worked to treat or prevent the disease. And then the studies were done, study after study after study. It didn't work to treat the disease. And like all medicines, it had a side effect, which could be, in this case, fatal, which was a heart arrhythmia. And so 2 months later, they then withdrew that authorization. That was a low moment for the FDA, because what it showed was that their arm could be twisted at the will of the administration. And then what happened was there were 10 states that said, all right, we don't trust this government. We are going to form our own vaccine advisory committee. We don't trust your FDA vaccine advisory committee. And it was chaotic. You know, remember, Kamala Harris said, you know, I don't trust you to make this vaccine. Yeah. And then what happened was, and I have this on very good authority, that Donald Trump pulled Stephen Hahn, who was the commissioner of the FDA, into his Oval Office and in an invective-laden tirade said, I want this vaccine out before the November election, which meant we wouldn't have had that 2-month safety follow-up after dose two, which is necessary.
This is so important, though. How do you explain the fact that the FDA bent on the first one, the hydroxychloroquine, but stood up to Trump on the vaccine? And what does that say about, I don't know, the independence of the FDA? Because you could draw two opposite conclusions here.
I think Stephen Hahn was burned by that first approval. I think he knew that very quickly after that happened. He wrote an op-ed piece in The Washington Post saying, you can trust me, I'm going to stand in the door. They regarding the vaccine. They put something on the website, said, don't worry, we're going to have a 2-month safety follow-up, which puts you into December, which was a month after the election. That's when we, the FDA Vaccine Advisory Committee, considered those vaccines. So he stood up, I think, when it was certainly important to stand up.
I got to ask you, because you talk about former President Trump in this book, and he's like this contradictory figure who does a lot of things really badly, but then Operation Warp Speed, you cite this as a big reason why the vaccine was able to come out so quickly and to save so many lives. Can you talk about this contradiction, this figure, and the political pressure? Just try to put it all together for us. Yeah,
I think the greatest accomplishment of the Trump administration was Operation Warp Speed, which basically was a program whereby they bet $11 billion on 6 horses to win one race. And they did it. It was a remarkable accomplishment. I mean, it's, I think the greatest medical accomplishment in my lifetime. It's amazing that he distances himself from the vaccine. Jimmy Kimmel argues that maybe it's because at his heart he's a very modest man who doesn't like to put his name on things, but I don't think that's it.
And my follow-up to that is this. I mean, is that a lesson? Like, because Operation Warp Speed worked so well, we could have another pandemic. I mean, is that one of the major lessons from this?
Yes. Well, actually, the March of Dimes was arguably my Operation Warp Speed 1, because that was sort of the massive sort of private philanthropic program that really paid for a handful of companies to make a polio vaccine. So in many ways, and that sped up the process. So this really was Operation Warp Speed 2.
But I think the question that you're left with is, you have this figure in Trump who is so manifestly uninterested in scientific inquiry in the process of creating solid science. But he's also in charge when this miraculous scientific progression happens. So you're left wondering, well, maybe do our leaders not matter? Does he deserve some credit for this? I mean, like, how do you fall on that question? Because it is confusing.
Well, his administration certainly deserves credit. Mm-hmm. And there were a number of people in the administration, including Alex Azar, who at Health and Human Services, who was a major force behind Operation Warp Speed. Peter Marks was a major force behind it. So there were people in the administration that certainly got it done. I'm not sure how cognizant he was of exactly all the details associated with Operation Warp Speed, but his administration did it.
He hired those people.
Yeah. One of the interesting things that I found out in reading your book was about misinformation and who actually benefits financially sometimes in some of these cases from the misinformation that came out during COVID and in other anti-vax folks. And you talked about alternative medicine industries. Can you talk about the link between, give us an example of a link between someone pushing misinformation within the community and directly benefiting from it.
Right. That was most surprising to me. There's a group called the Center for Countering Digital Hate, and they did a deep dive on these, what they called sort of the 12 people or groups that the New York Times ultimately called the Disinformation Dozen that was behind putting out all this misinformation and disinformation. And the single greatest source of funding for all of them was the alternative medicine industry, the dietary supplement industry, because they too sort of promote medical freedoms, let us make claims about certain things that aren't necessarily proven by scientific fact. So they support, you know, people like Alex Jones, Tucker Carlson, also sort of have their hands in the alternative medicine industry. So it's, I don't know, it's kind of this chaos, you know, this kind of anti-scientific bias. I mean, I would argue the term alternative medicine is the wrong term, because if an alternative medicine works, it's not an alternative. And if it doesn't work, it's not an alternative. If it works, it's medicine.
The other big question I'm left with after reading your chronicle of these 4 years is how public health messaging should work. Should public health officials always sort of make their recommendations purely grounded in the science, almost in a vacuum? Or should they modify their recommendations or suggestions based on how the public might receive a piece of information? And I'm thinking of the Biden administration sort of telling everyone to go ahead and get boosters if you're over age 12. I took that as a recommendation to kind of boost, no pun intended, people's trust in this updated vaccine, and also to not confuse people, to not break it up into, like, you know, 15 different groups. Just make a blanket recommendation. But you thought that was the wrong call. And again, I go back to that larger question of, like, okay, should we just give people the pure medical advice, or should we cut that with some considerations of how they might interpret it?
I think every policy, every government policy, every CDC policy has to be grounded in excellent science. And when, as you note, President Biden stood up in front of the American public on August 18th of 2021 and said, as of 1 month hence, in the week of September 20th, we are going to offer a third dose of vaccine, a booster dose of vaccine for everybody over 12. That wasn't supported by the science. The goal of this vaccine was to prevent serious illness, keep people out of the hospital, keep them out of the intensive care unit, keep them from dying. At that point, before Omicron had come into the United States, that was still true. And so he also bypassed both the FDA and CDC when he made that announcement. And when that came to the advisory committees 1 month later, we both basically rejected it and said, sure, a third dose for those over 65 makes sense, but not for everybody. And I think people were confused then. You had the president saying everybody's going to get a third dose. You had two advisory committees, the FDA and CDC, saying, no, that's not necessary. And at that point, people were confused about what it meant to be protected against this virus.
So what are the lessons that we would take to a future pandemic about, you know, public health communication, about political pressure on our FDA? What are the main things you would take away from 4 years ago?
No, and CDC. So for example, in July of 2021, 7 months after that vaccine was out, there was an outbreak in Provincetown, Massachusetts, mm-hmm. right? 1,000 men get together, celebrate the July 4th holiday, most are vaccinated. Nonetheless, there's an outbreak and 346 men get COVID, only 4 are hospitalized. That's great. A hospitalization rate of 1.2%. That's a vaccine working well. The rest had asymptomatic or mild infection, which the CDC unfortunately labeled in
breakthrough.
Breakthrough, wrong word. Breakthrough implies failure. This wasn't a failure. This was a vaccine doing exactly what you wanted it to do, keeping people out of the hospital. And people heard that and they thought, wait a second, I'm mandated to get this vaccine. I've gotten a couple of doses. Now I have mild to moderate infection. CDC lied to me. The breakthrough was the wrong word. They should have celebrated that moment in July 4th when you saw how well that vaccine was working at keeping these men out of the hospital.
So that's one of the lessons about public health communication.
Yes, explain what these vaccines can and can't do. And I mm-hmm. think we sometimes don't do that. And I think what we were worried about was, you know, by July of 2021, 70% of the U.S. population had been vaccinated, but 30% hadn't, and we'd hit a wall. And I think there was a sense of maybe overpromising that if you get the vaccine, you won't transmit the virus, which is not true, is you won't get symptomatic infection, which wasn't true.
We're wrapping up, though, but all that requires nuance. And sometimes I do wonder if the better mm-hmm. approach is just sort of like giving people a very clear directive, even if it's, you know, not quite 100% grounded in the science. But you say no, like expect people to understand the nuance, give them the nuance and go from there.
Yes, I think trust the American public to try and understand the science. Explain it as well as you can, compassionately, passionately, clearly. And then you have the best chance.
And let them sit with the uncertainty because the information's going to change. The science is going to change. Tell them that and trust that they're going to be able to understand that.
And we have to be able to trust them for that because that's always true. I mean, I think if I asked you, do you think you're going to know more about science and medicine 50 years from now than we know now? I think you'd both say yes. But when it comes to your disease, or in this case, our pandemic, you want to believe you know everything you need to know right now, and that's not going to be true.
Lots of lessons learned.
Thank you, Paul. That's Paul Offit, author of Tell Me When It's Over. He's a pediatrician and director of the Vaccine Education Center at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Thanks again for your time.
Thank you.
And that, friends, wraps up our show today. Our producers are Debbie Bilder and Andreas Copes. Our audio general manager is Joan Isabella. Al Banks engineered the show today. From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron. We will talk to you again next week.
Next week.